Certainly pleased to see everyone who is able to be here with us this evening as we conclude this meeting that we have had on the subject of apologetics. I have been very pleased and feel as if that everything has gone well thus far. I feel very benefited to have heard all of the lessons that have been taught so far, and I hope that everyone who has been able to hear everything that has been taught throughout the meeting also feels the same. For a few moments this evening, I'm going to speak on what is considered a philosophical argument for the existence of God. We may have to do without images, which is the argument from the perspective or analogy of the watchmaker, also called the teleological argument. Okay, good. Also, please bear with me as we go throughout the service. I've been fighting with losing my voice for a little bit, and I hope that it sticks with me long enough to be able to convey all of the information that I would like to. Teleology is not a word that is within my regular vocabulary, and I would suspect that it's probably not in most people's, but I assure you as we get into this, it will become clear that knowing what teleology is much easier than trying to pronounce it, and we will get further into its definition as we go along. I would like to start by looking at Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4. Hebrews 3 and 4 says, "For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God." We know from this passage that Scripture claims that all things were created by a divine maker, the very thing that we have been studying throughout this meeting. And surely all things that are created ought to be evidence then of their creator. If we turn to Romans chapter 1, verses 16 through 25, this is a passage that is often used to begin apologetic studies because it gives a biblical basis for such things. I've put it up here if you would like to read along. It is somewhat of a lengthy passage, but I also think it's important for the things that we are going to study as we go along. And after this, I hope to draw out some particular points from the passage. This reads, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, 'The just shall live by faith.' For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because, although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever and ever. Amen." This passage indicates a few specific things to its readers that I think will be important to us as we go along and continue studying apologetics. First, we see in verse 17 that faith is an evidence of God. Now, this lends itself more to another type of philosophical argument called the ontological argument, which has not been specifically addressed during this meeting as a lesson, but which I'm sure the teachers would be willing to speak with anyone who had questions about after services. Also, those who do not believe in God merely suppress their belief because his existence has been shown to them. And we will look at the ways throughout this lesson in which it has been shown. Third, we know that creation is an evidence of the Creator. And fourthly, those who suppress knowledge of God do so by attributing his power to created things. One of the reasons that the young people here thought that it was a good idea to also deal with philosophical apologetics in addition to other types is that it is possible to mistake nature and science for God, and that is often what is done. When atheists try and claim that there is no God, they would like to put nature or science in his place, but God is necessary in order to explain those things as well. There are, if then the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen in creation, there should be clear evidences of his existence that are understandable to us. First, for something to be understood, we must be capable of understanding it. Sometimes the notion of God is rejected over differences of opinion regarding what constitutes knowledge. It is for this purpose, again, that our meeting has not only dealt with scientific apologetics, but also defenses of the existence of God from a rational philosophical standpoint. To answer, can we know God exists, we might first begin by asking, how is anything known? Most people, scholars and laymen alike, will agree on typically three major avenues by which knowledge may be gained. The first of which, as you can see, is experience. This deals with sensory information and perception, as well as empirical science, which we have heard about earlier in this meeting. The second, which I would like to focus on this afternoon, and Brother Barnes will also focus on after me, is rationality, or using our logical faculties to deduce information. And then another way is through revelation, learning from someone who is more knowledgeable than we are, or being told, or coming to some sort of epiphany from an outside source. Prior studies in this meeting have already looked at a few defenses from the point of view of empirical science as well as divine revelation that could not come from the human mind, as we heard this morning. This lesson will focus on how to use rationalistic approaches to knowledge in the philosophical sense. It is important to note, though, that experience or empiricism is not the only way to know something. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe," in John chapter 20 and verse 29. And so we know that some of these evidences of God must come from something outside of our sensory perception. Faith can be based on sensory experience, as we have already discussed throughout this meeting, but there are also other proofs for the legitimacy of our faith. This is also not outside our usual day-to-day use of reason. Consider for a moment a concept such as freedom. Freedom does not in and of itself have physical properties which we experience, and yet we acknowledge its existence because we understand what it is and allow it to motivate our actions and thus shape our reality as well. Christians may argue that the only purpose for having reason at all is to serve God. Service comes from making a free choice to act selflessly. Only humans possess the faculties to make moral decisions and therefore also provide willful acts of service, which seems to indicate to some extent that our purpose is to exercise these faculties. The prophet of Ecclesiastes writes that the meaning of life is to fear God and keep his commandments in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 13. It is upon this premise that all things with purpose must first be purposed by an outside source that we build the foundation for what we call the teleological argument for the existence of God. I do not expect to deal with every variation of this form of argument or to spend all of my time refuting every possible rebuttal to it, as it is still a hotly contested contention among scientists and philosophers in the religious world today, but simply I would rather like to explain it and offer counterarguments to a few of the major attacks that have been made against it in history in order to legitimize it as a way for us to create a basis for reasonable argumentation with others if they are interested in hearing such things. The word teleology may be formally defined in a number of ways. I'm going to read three ways that Merriam-Webster defines it that we can use to understand teleology, but the primary definition that I'm going to look at is the first one, which is the study of evidences of design in nature. This may also be defined as a doctrine that ends are immanent in nature, or also a doctrine explaining phenomena by final causes. The teleological argument will focus on final causes, and then when we hear Brother Barnes in a bit speak about the cosmological argument, that will deal with proving the existence of God from first causes. Teleology comes from the Greek word telos, which means end or goal. So a teleological argument is a defense of God's existence by looking at purpose. No end result is achieved without working toward that end. So purposes are inherent in nature. Wherever there are ends, there are also purposes. For example, William Paley, a Christian philosopher, gave the analogy of a watchmaker in 1802. He built on premises that were provided by many famous thinkers before him, many of whom were not specifically Christians, such as Xenophanes, Plato, and Descartes, which might eliminate any perception of bias that some may try and attribute to his analogy. An excerpt of Paley's writings in natural theology goes like this. In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer I had before given, that for anything I knew the watch might have always been there. There may have existed at some time and at some place or other an artificer or artificers who formed the watch for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch exists in the works of nature, with the difference on the side of nature of being greater or more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation. So summarized, the watchmaker analogy brings up that one, upon finding a watch, would never believe that it put itself together and kept perfect time or fulfilled the purpose or the end result that it was designed to reach. There must have at some point been a designer to carefully assemble that watch in order for it to function. This is also stated to be a self-evident principle, something that is easily perceived by anyone who honestly assesses such a situation. Teleological arguments are reflective of what Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10, which says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." So there are both reasons stemming from inside the Bible and outside the Bible in order for us to buy into teleological thinking and setting it up as a basis for us to use as a defense for the existence of God. Sometimes teleology is thrown out by thinkers as unknowable because it predates Darwin's work on evolution. In its modern use, this argument also relies on something that's called Occam's razor, which I will explain further shortly, in order to refute Darwin's contemporaries. But for example, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins tries to refute this argument by saying that he could explain the potential for complex systems to result from nature during the processes of evolution. This creates a number of problems, first of which it gives no advantage to his antithesis. For example, if all he can prove is the potential for naturally occurring complex systems, then his argument is not particularly better than Christian contentions, which he says only prove the theoretical possibility of God. It further deals with processes within nature and does not account for the existence of nature itself, nor how nature came to be. And also, it is flawed when we applied what's called Occam's razor. This is a tool used in philosophy that essentially states that the simplest, most understandable solution to any given problem is usually the best solution to use. Christians may note, in this case, that Dawkins relies on many complex hypothetical situations to give his argument plausibility, while the teleological argument is relatively simple and easy to deduce based on truths that may be concluded by anyone who looks at nature around them versus those who only understand complicated science or think that they might. Another evidence of teleology is the fact that anything with purpose has some degree of order to it. The early Greek thinker Xenophanes, who lived approximately 500 years before Christ, rejected the idea of many gods, but believed in a single creator whose existence was clear because he saw order in the universe. This position has been expanded upon by contemporary American philosopher Norman Melkert. He writes regarding Xenophanes in his text, The Great Conversation, that both early and modern thinkers seem to commonly believe that where there is order, there is intelligence. The atheistic basis for science has not been used until a relatively current time. It's a new development. Melkert offers this explanation of Xenophanes' position. Consider the state of papers on your desk or tools in your workshop. If you were like me, soon you will find that these things, if left to their own devices, degenerate slowly into a state of chaos. Soon it is impossible to find what you want when you need it, and it becomes impossible to work. What you need to do then is deliberately, and with some intelligent plan in mind, impose order on the chaos. Order is the result of intelligent action, it seems. It doesn't just happen, according to page 16. It is by this standard that we might understand when teleology is present. Whenever there is some sort of ordering, there is intent, purpose, and an end to be met. If a thing does something, then it has purpose. There are so many things that we naturally do and must do that we have little to no control over, breathing or allowing our heartbeat, for instance, or the inevitability of dying. These things keep the system of our bodies in order, and we have no choice in the matter for a long time, and limited choice over those matters as we grow older. And the human body is just one natural phenomenon that indicates purpose. All nature seems to convey order, and therefore organization of some kind, and behind that organization, of course, intent as well. The idea of ordering requiring intelligence reminds me very much of when Paul preached to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17, verses 24 through 28, about their worship of an unknown God. That passage says, "God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives life, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things, and has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your poets have said, for we also are his offspring." From Paul's message here, we might learn another set of things that we can use to apply to the teleological argument. We know, of course, that God gives life to all things, indicating that all natural things follow his purpose, and that is why we find order in the world around us. Secondly, we know that he has made all men. Thirdly, that he has set times and boundaries which convey inevitable end results, and therefore also teleology. And fourthly, that in him we live and move and have our being. We know that our own existence is dependent upon God and the order which he has given to our world. As we have noticed in lessons before this, there is no way in which we would even be able to live or function on this planet without the way that God has set the universe in order. Arguments about order proving God's existence were not limited to ancient times, though. Perhaps the most influential writer and orator apologizing for the existence of God in the academic world was the philosopher Thomas Aquinas. Melkert's book that was mentioned earlier pulls an excerpt from one of Aquinas' works that explains a teleological argument that the author called the argument from the guidelines of nature. He writes, "Goal-directed behavior is observed in all bodies of nature, even those lacking awareness. For we see their behavior hardly ever varying, and practically always turning out well, which shows they truly tend to goals and do not merely hit them by accident. But lacking nothing, but nothing lacking awareness can tend to a goal except it be directed by someone with awareness and understanding, arrows by archers, for example. So everything in nature is directed to its goal by someone with understanding, and this we call God," according to page number 281. Of course, viewpoints favoring the existence of God have also come up against opposition, some of which we have already noted. One of the most popular philosophical arguments against apologetics, such as those that we have already addressed, is that Christians do not differentiate between God's essence and his existence. That is, not differentiate between what he is and his actual being, but simply that they imply that because they can, or they believe that they can understand something about his essence, that they may also infer his existence. Philosophers such as David Hume have been those to heavily criticize Christians with this argument. It is construed as irrational and unable to determine the difference between causality and correlation. This is a complex argument that has been countered in a number of ways over the years. I'm going to note just one particular way that it may be refuted. I bring it up only so that we might see that despite criticisms, the teleological argument still stands and survives today, and there are any number of ways that one can use to overcome the criticisms that have befallen it. To give an example of how one might counter the existence-essence argument, consider the words of French philosopher René Descartes in his fifth recording on Meditations. He starts by recognizing the so-called existence-essence argument, and then giving an example of what it is before he moves on to dispel it. Descartes writes, "It may be that Just as I can imagine a winged horse when no such horse exists, I can ascribe existence to God when no God exists. No, there is a fallacy here. From the fact that I can't think of a mountain without a valley, it follows not that the mountain and valley don't exist, but only that whether they exist or not cannot be separated from one another. But from the fact that I can think of a mountain, that I cannot think of God without existence, it follows that existence is inseparable from him, and hence that he really exists. The idea here about existence and essence is that sometimes they go together and are inseparable, such as in the case of God. If we look at a mountain, we might notice that a valley is inevitable whenever a mountain exists, and also that whenever there is a valley, there must be a mountain, because the two are a part of one another and form one another. This defense has been given to support a number of arguments, ontological, teleological, and cosmological, but it just essentially states that God's existence is a part of his essence. If we look here, this shows what a mountain without a valley would look like, or a valley without a mountain that is just flat land. Either both the mountain and the valley exist, or neither of them exist. And this is important because it explains that Christians are not finding an attribute such as order or teleology and ascribing it to merely a concept or a non-existent being, but rather that these attributes serve as evidences of a supreme creator. I would like for us to consider just one more aspect of teleology that was brought up by Aquinas before we close this particular lesson. One thing that humans must develop is morality. Everyone has an idea of good and bad, but those without religion do so arbitrarily because they do not have any way to know what the greatest good is. Due to the fact that developing some sort of sense of morality is inevitable in human nature, and also involuntary, it is a purpose or end that we must serve, or a part of teleology. From this premise, we can find one more apology that Aquinas calls the argument from grades and goodness in things, which has also been termed the moral argument by later thinkers. He says, some things are found to be better, truer, more excellent than others. For example, the hotter... Truer, more excellent than others. Such comparative terms describe varying degrees of approximation to a superlative. For example, things are hotter the nearer they approach what is hottest. So, there is something which is the truest and best and most excellent of things. There is something that causes in all other beings their being, their goodness, and whatever perfections that they may have. Aquinas contends that this most good being is, of course, God. We would have no conception of good if it were not for a most good being in existence in order for us to know what it is that we are working toward when we say that we are trying to be good. This is consistent with scriptural teachings as well. Matthew chapter 19, Mark chapter 10, and Luke chapter 18 all give an account of Jesus claiming that no one is good except God. And we might notice that the good being spoken of here is an unqualified good in wholeness and in purity. Taking things in a bit of a different direction now, we might recognize that the true and real God has created a set of ends that everyone should be aware of. Teleology plays a role in our Christian lives as well. We are told in Hebrews chapter 9, verses 27 and 28, "And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation." Death and judgment are unavoidable, and so we have to prepare now in the time that we have, before there is no time left at all. In order to prepare, we must recall our one true purpose and ultimate goal as humans. As was discussed earlier in the writings of the prophet of Ecclesiastes, we must keep God's commandments. This is our all. This is the goal that each of us ought to be working toward. These are the thoughts which I have prepared. We will now have a song, and then we will hear about the cosmological argument from Brother Matthew Barnes.